This is side one of tape two of the Rear Admiral Hibbard interview. Well, good morning, Jimmy. We're here again. It's the 22nd of November. Mount Baker is showing up beautifully. What's that island over there? Is that San Juan?
You see San Juan, yes. Yeah, across the way.
In talking over our last session, you mentioned that you thought you had been, you didn't say, well, too critical, whatever you said. So I pointed out that this did not always mean pejorative, and you wanted to put on the record that.
I was concerned I might have been sounded, to use the word, critical of my senior officers who were trying to survive, to keep a Navy alive. As you know, Canadian governments have never been the least interested in defense. It's the lowest priority. And for years, these senior officers in the Canadian Navy wondered how the Navy was going to last from year to year. And what I said yesterday was I returned, called back to Canada from a wonderful running flotilla working with the Home and Mediterranean Fleet. We were convinced we had to get ready for war. We were training like mad for war. And I was asked to come back to Canada and go as first lieutenant of a four-masted schooner. Now, I'm not going to downgrade sail training. I'm not going to downgrade any form of training. But I am. I was so disappointed, I wondered if I should leave the Navy at the time.
Yeah.
And my wife reminded me last night of letters that I thought of retiring from the Navy because I did not sense a feeling in Canada. And this is where I want to be fair to my senior officers. Mm-hmm. The Canadian government never occurred to them in those days to get ready. I never know when. I don't think it ever has. To get ready for war.
Yeah.
And that was very disheartening to anybody who spent 2 years, three British destroyers, getting ready for war. And that hit me very forcibly. And I really thought of retiring at that time. Now, well, I'd not be critical of my own officers because all they were trying to do to keep the Navy alive.
Well, that was Admiral Nenny's magnificent contribution. He did keep the Navy alive during the 30s.
Hose, particularly.
Hose first, and then
Nellis. That's right.
Hose brought the Navy to Canada by spreading the RCNVR divisions across Canada.
Yes.
Through your brother,
Got Hubert.
Yeah. And
H.J.F. Hubert.
H.J.F., yes. He was called Pappy. No, that was Musgrave.
Called Paff. Because
Paff. How do you spell it?
Or P-A-F-F, because he used to talk about when he went into the Russian Revolution in 1918, right after the First World War, and he used to explain how he'd sit in the ship and he'd be Paff, Paff. He was talking about the bullets were coming from shore at the ship all the time when he was in the Black Sea, minesweeping.
Oh, I see. That's how he got Paff.
Yeah, that's how he got the name Paff. All his pals known him as Paff.
Yeah. So that was the contribution of your seniors. Yeah. They did the best they could. And they did very well in keeping us alive. But to go back a little bit, which you know from your reading of history, but I'll just remind you, the Royal Navy kept Canada free for over 100 years.
That's right.
And when I think Sir Wilfrid Laurier went over to the UK once, and he said to the Foreign Secretary, if you want our support, call us to your councils.
Yes.
And the Foreign Secretary said, welcome, but pay as you enter.
That's right. We've never paid our dues.
We've never paid our dues, and Peter Newman is making that point today.
We never paid our dues to the club.
And so we started in 1910, and we didn't do that much in World War One, but we did partially man two cruisers, and it was Admiral Hose, I guess, who started the East Coast Flotilla of anti-submarine small boats, about 40 of them. Niobe was doing patrols off New York. Rainbow was out here. I guess her main armament was her wireless set in case she saw any German cruisers. So I understand the good nature with which you present this critique of what had gone on before. We just weren't ready. We weren't ready for World War I. We weren't ready for World War II. And you nearly resigned over it. Thank God you didn't.
Well, thank you.
Thank God you didn't. So you brought Skeena back, and we'll move on to the battle trainer after this, and your Iroquois time. You brought Skeena back. You were a captain at sea. You had been in battle. You brought Skeena back, and you were now working out of Newfoundland, and your Captain D was?
Captain Stevens.
Stevens.
Very fine, Captain D. Captain E.B.K. Stevens. Captain D. Newfoundland in
fine.
September, October, November, December, 1941.
Yep. So, you're in Skeena, you're based in Newfoundland.
That's right.
Will you go on from there?
Well, we were running, you're taking leading convoys coming out from Halifax, the SC convoys and the HX convoys, and meeting them outside to the eastward of the Straits of Belle Isle.
Yeah, yeah.
Off Newfoundland, and taking That's them over as far as Iceland,
yeah.
Where we met the other next group who picked them up to take them into UK.
Yeah, you're talking about West Stomp.
That's it. I can't remember the term.
We
were doing the Mid-Ocean Escort Group.
That's right.
It was called the Mid-Ocean Escort Group, and we met them outside Newfoundland, that's the Straits of Belle Isle, or if they came south of the Algonquin, and then went just east of Newfoundland, and we were met at about 22 west, off south of Iceland.
Yeah.
That was our... called the Mid-Ocean Escort Group.
Yeah.
And now we'd done two or three convoys there when you said you wanted to discuss what point here?
Well, was there anything happened? I joined you and Moose joined SC-42. I know about that, and we're going to talk about it, but was there anything before that you wanted to comment on?
No, we were convoys were pretty not very, there weren't heavy attacks on those convoys at that time. In the summer, I'm talking about the summer of 1941, it seemed very easy going after the West Coast, after the Western approaches, where I don't remember one convoy not being attacked. During the autumn of 1940, in the spring of 41, I was attacked nearly every convoy.
Yes. By bombers, mostly.
No, submarines too. That's coming out of Liverpool to 20 West. That's
yeah.
when we were working on Western approaches.
Yeah.
Now I'm shifted to Canada
yeah.
and moved into the... I'm talking about Skeena, not
yeah,
my
I know.
Group.
Yeah, I know. So, but Captain Donald McIntyre, in his 1961 book, The Battle of the Atlantic, you have a copy by Pan Books Limited, London. He says in here that the ships were easy to build quickly, the corvettes to start with. It wasn't so easy to train the men.
Okay.
And he says, and so it was agreed, whatever he said can be checked, it's in here, that a good place for the RCN to do its training was on the western side of the Atlantic, where there wasn't so much activity. And this proved not to be the case. And we weren't as well trained as we should have been. And I think nearly all of us would agree that we weren't as well trained as we should have been. Or we were certainly as well trained as we could have been.
It was... I think I've documented that very fully in my report of proceedings of SC-42.
Yes.
I think I've gone on record in several places on it, but Canada, You want to hear the Canadian building situation, and that's what you want to discuss now?
Not particularly, because that's on file, and we know. Yeah. But comment of Captain McIntyre's, do you think was a fair comment?
Yes. What had happened was Canadian government was putting tremendous pressure to get out more ships and more men. And by building more ships and more men, as fast as you can, giving them, the schools have done what they could, but they had not had battle training. And to go against an efficient, dedicated enemy, as the Germans were, as untrained as we were, was a tragedy. Now, I'm not going to be unfair in these remarks, but I want to point out that I don't think anybody understood who hadn't been in the battle from the first day, which I was lucky to be, mm-hmm. and been attacked many, many times, mm-hmm. that these were, as I repeat, a most dedicated, efficient group of submarines the world has ever seen, I would think.
Yeah.
And to go into battle with no idea of this was too much and unfair on those dedicated Canadians from all walks of life in Canada,
yeah.
who manned these ships, trained, keen, to do their utmost, all volunteers, and to expect them to hold their own against that enemy who'd still be fighting today yeah. if Germany hadn't collapsed. They were so good right to the end of the war.
Oh, they took terrible losses, and they fought right to the end, the U-boat arm.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no revolution in the Navy in the Second World War as there was in the First.
Well,
I tried to
document in various
papers. Well, that is documented.
Yes.
Now, in SC-42, you only had three escorts, and the darn convoy was what, 65 ships?
Yes, 66 ships,
6 miles across the front, yourself.
Covered ten square miles.
Ten square miles, you in the van, Conogamy, Cowboy Jackson, Aurelia, Ted Briggs.
That's right.
And
all dedicated people.
And who else was the third corvette? I forgot.
I can't remember.
I'll put it in the tape. I've got a computer at home. The first night, it was the night we joined you, it was the night you were attacked, about 3:30 in the morning.
Well, I'd been attacked 2 days before that.
Ah.
We joined SC-42, and we got into a huge Atlantic deal, just unbelievable Atlantic deal, and the convoy became separated and spread out. Well, just after 2 or 3 days, complete gales, we were all over the ocean. So I had to break W.T. silence to let the Eastern Escort Group, the people to meet us, that we were at least 3 days late. We were only making 2 knots mm-hmm. in these gales. Mm-hmm. And we were up to three days late arriving at the Eastern Rendezvous. Well, I had to break W.T. silence for them. And that apparently would, of course, give our way our position.
Did you pull away from the convoy to break W.T. silence?
No, couldn't. You see, we were trying to get a convoy together. Have you ever seen a scattered convoy?
I have. Yeah.
Well, it is quite a task to get a scattered convoy into, and we were all over the ocean trying to get them, shepherd them together again. And, well, I suppose, McIntyre says there were 17 submarines in the area, in that area.
Yeah.
The Admiralty turned us to the north, and we went up off Cape
Farewell.
Farewell, and we just skimmed the shores of Iceland, but at that time, the submarines were trailing us, were homing, and we could hear them homing, submarines onto our convoy.
They chatted away in the RT lounge like the Americans did.
Well, they more than that. They homed
the other submarines to where they were in sight. So Munerik went down. She was the one, the SS Munerik, I remember, was the first one went down. The night we joined it was, yeah. M-U-N-E-R-I-C.
That duck convoy is well documented. I'll tell you about that convoy. Read your report of proceedings is SC-42. The times and the sinkings of that convoy is in my report of proceedings, because the night my report of proceedings on that convoy was drawn up my only night in harbor in a month, but it was accurate because I had wonderful chap called Wilcox, Frank Wilcox, who was afterwards senior partner at Price Waterhouse, and I had...
What was Wilcox?
He was my gunnery officer in this game.
For a moment, who was your first lieutenant?
The poor fellow came to a sad ending because of an incident in the Ontario later.
It'll come.
Yes.
He was an RCN officer?
RCN, special entry, yeah. Fine officer.
So you put your
report... B, son of a doctor in Victoria.
It's in the naval list.
Yes.
Boak.
Yeah.
Eric Boak. Oh, yes. Well, he was my captain later in Sioux.
Was he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Eric Boak was your first lieutenant.
A fine officer.
Oh, yeah.
And Eric Boak. Well, now, your question, Bean?
My question was, there was that one night where we now, because Chambly and Moose Jaw have joined, and Chambly has sunk U-501.
Yeah.
And we have the captain on board. You remember he jumped on board Moose Jaw? I noticed that Captain McIntyre doesn't say Moose Jaw rammed U-501. He says Moose Jaw collided with U-501. I'll let that pass without comment, but that's the way he put it. Ted Briggs was astern. He sent you a most enigmatic signal, says Captain McIntyre, that he was carrying out your orders and he'd get in touch with you in the morning, and he said he had a good reason.
Yes.
And you, in the heat of the battle, said, all right, do it. But what he did, in fact, was take a torpedoed ship in tow and go off to Iceland, which left you with one escort less. What did you think of that?
Well, of course, that was most unfortunate, because how many ships we would have saved with an extra corvette, I don't know. I see that my Captain D, writing his remarks on my report, said the reference to so-and-so, despite the fact that Aurelia undoubtedly performed a fine and successful feat of seamanship in towing Tashi safely into port, I consider the action of the commanding officer Aurelia in leaving the convoy for this purpose was an error of judgment, observing that it deprived the surviving ship of the convoy 25% of their escort. But that's the thing.
Well, what's the date of that letter?
That's the date of that letter. It's the 1st of October, 1941.
Has it got a file number?
Secret Skeena 01, 18th of September, my report of proceedings. To Commodore Newfoundland Forces, copy to Skeena. This is the report. He said, this is an Captain D said here, this is an appalling tale of disaster, but I feel it is impossible to criticize any single action of the senior officer, Lieutenant Commander J.C. Hibbert. On the contrary, I consider that he handled what must have appeared to be a hopeless situation with energy, initiative throughout, probably thereby averting most disaster.
Mm-hmm.
That's Captain E.B.K. Stevens. And
18th September 41, as you say, and there's no particular file number, it just says
secret. Well, here's
secret.
The one that may do it. Here's Captain, Commander-in-Chief, to Commander-in-Chief Western Approaches, to Naval Service Secretary, copy to Commander-in-Chief, report of Skeena's SC-42. This is signed by L.W. Murray, Commodore Commanding Newfoundland Escort Forces. You can read what it says that minute. I'm a bit embarrassed.
Well, the
There's such a thing as pride, and there's such a thing as false pride. And you haven't got a bit of false pride.
This is, as you say, dated October 10th, 41. He considers that Lieutenant Commander J.C. Hibbert, RCN, has acquitted himself in this action in a manner in which the Royal Canadian Navy may well be proud. Oh, isn't this marvelous? Not only did he never lose hope, with a meager force at his disposal, a lesser man might have done, but his mental and physical stamina was sufficient to keep him alert and active from the time of the first report of attack at 1004 9 September until he left Valfjord at 0400 12 September, a period of 66 hours, much of which was continuous battle. Well, it's on file. I won't go on except to say you show the same energy today.
Thank you. Don't feel it. Well,
so that's Ted Briggs in Orillia. But he was a merchant seaman, and the thought of a ship sinking, you know, was just appalling to him, I guess.
Yes, he was a fine officer. As I say, everybody did their best. But my report of proceedings, I think, is as accurate as I could be, because we sat up all night, and I had good people helping me, and then 1 o'clock in the morning, we'd sent for somebody who'd been on the bridge. We brought people in while it was fresh in everybody's mind. Exactly what we did that night and that 3 days battle.
Yeah.
And we recorded it all in my cabin with my first lieutenant, Wilcox, and Dr. Oak, who was a tremendous help.
I knew Oak. Yeah, Oak. A very pleasant man.
He came from Oakville.
Did he?
Yes. My wife said, "Who's your doctor?" And I said, "Oak." And he said, "Where's he from?" And I said, "Oakville." She nearly hit me. But he was a fine doctor.
Yeah.
And
it's quite a name.
He was very worried about my health during this thing.
Well, I'm sure he was. 66 hours on the bridge.
That I would collapse, but I handled it away.
In what way did you collapse? You mean?
Well, he worried that I might.
Oh, he's worried about it.
He kept worried about me all the time. Kept coming up.
Yeah.
Got your tea, got your coffee, got your cocoa. He was being terribly attentive.
Yeah, well, as well he might. I mean, he would have done it anyway because he probably loved you, but his life depended on it too.
Did you ever read his story of the SC-42?
No, what's it in?
I'll show it to you in my scrapbook here.
Yeah, I'll look at that. Okay, we've got Dr. Oak's story of SC-42. So I just wanted to cover that bit about...
He brings out the human factor, the people, the types of... But the sailors, how the sailors reacted.
Yes.
He brings that out. I'll show you. It's a little book he wrote on it.
They reacted in the most unusual way many times. I remember when I repeated the order, "Stand by to ram," which is what Freddie Grubb passed to me.
Yeah.
Throughout the ship, it was an extraordinary reaction. Throughout the ship, the whole of the ship's company started shouting, "Reef it! Reef it!"
You know, people rise to great heights and difficulties.
Yeah.
It is a difficulty to bring out the best in people.
It is.
The President of the United States had made the remark, "Adversity introduces a man to himself."
Yes.
Adversity introduces a man to himself.
Yeah.
And that showed up all war. The Battle of Britain, people, everywhere you look, adversity introduces a man to himself.
Yeah, well, we know that's true.
It brings out the best.
After SC-42, any other convoys that you'd like to mention briefly?
Well, I don't think so. They're all recorded in different reports of proceedings.
Yeah.
And Mark Milner has written the story of the Newfoundland Escort Force. I think I'm only quoting things that he will know about.
Yes.
But to bring up the human side of this thing, I want to just cannot miss this opportunity without saying that merchant navy, and the thought of them brings a lump in my throat even to this day. We lost a quarter of a convoy, 25% sunk. Not that many survivors. These people...
No rescue ships.
No rescue ships. We've managed to get a few... pick up a few survivors. But
there were no rescue ships
as
such.
Nothing. And when that convoy arrived, I still show you sometime the letter I have. If you have it in the papers I showed you here the other day. When that convoy got to UK, every captain signed a letter thanking me and my group for what we had done. Or, you know, that is unbelievable. That here was a merchant. This merchant ships obeyed every signal. They did everything.
Commodore Mackenzie was pretty good.
He was good, nice fellow. And I didn't know him personally, but those surviving captains, I've still got that letter. I treasure it. I'll never part with it. It'll go to my files when I die. Yeah. But that letter from those captains, signed, thanking the escort for what we had done, considering we'd lost 25% of the convoy. My own ship's company, when I read that letter to them, felt so strongly. They'd saved enough money for a Christmas dance, and they took this money, and they decided to use their money to decorate the ground floor of the Allied Merchant Seamen's Club in Halifax.
Isn't that marvelous?
Well, those are things that mean, you know, it's hard to make people understand that unless you've seen it, but these are things that matter to me.
Yeah.
Those are, and they, my own ship's company, decided not to have the Christmas ball that they'd saved their money, canteen fund for, and they would put that money into the Allied Merchant Seamen's Club in Halifax. That's nice.
That's wonderful. So, other submarines in Skeena? Other U-boats?
The attacks I had in the mid-ocean group were not many. I could give you attack after attack off the western approaches in 1940-41, but this period I had a non-eventful convoys until I was December, when I was appointed training commander in Halifax.
Now that brings us to the battle trainer, for which all the preamble to this is to show your qualifications to be the training commander in Halifax of these raw youths coming from all over Canada, going to sea and fighting. Do you know when we went to sea, the first in Moose Jaw, the first lieutenant, the captain, of course, was permanent force.
Mm-hmm.
The first lieutenant had never been to sea before. The navigator had a mate's coasting ticket and hadn't been to sea for 28 years. I had had a year making cocoa for the Office of the Watch in an armed merchant cruiser. The other sub-lieutenant had never been to sea before. In the lower deck, there was one permanent force leading seaman, Nantau, N-A-N-T-E-A-U, and that was the professional complement of Moose Jaw, the captain and a killick. So there's the difficulty. So you were training commander. You knew about these difficulties firsthand. So what did you do about it as training commander?
Well, it was obvious to me that the pressure of the government, on the pressure put on the Canadian government to get the ships into the Atlantic, where we take tremendous losses, and the naval board were doing a magnificent job in building ships, recruiting was excellent, spirit was excellent, the schools were doing their utmost to turn them out. But as the Prime Minister Menzies once said of Australia, you cannot become romantic about a navy overnight. You cannot. You can go to the schools, but you've got to be experienced in battle to fight that dedicated enemy. Mm-hmm. And I found myself responsible for training these ships. Some of them arrived in Halifax because the river St. Lawrence ran that way. I mean, it was a very serious situation. We were manning these ships. We were dedicated people, but they had not had the training as a ship or a group of ships how to fight.
That's right.
How to fight.
So what did you do?
Well, I formed, my training was to get ships and groups of ships and take them down to St. Margaret's Bay, pick two places we put them aside for training. And I would do night actions. Most actions were at night, as you know.
Yeah.
And I would, one night, I was at sea. I think I must have had 10 or 12 escorts acting in this ship. I was training about 10 ships. And I had my ship, training ship, was center. I was acting as convoy. And I had 2 MLs attacking, because we knew submarines were attacking so much on the surface. And
so what were you in?
I was in the...
A Corvette?
Yes, I was in a Corvette. I'm not sure which one.
And you had a Corvette screening you.
I had Corvettes screening me.
And the MLs were attacking.
Yeah. That is later. We did this one night, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, we anchored. I sent for all captains right away. I was never so depressed in my life. I think 4 points out of 5 had been wrong. I was able to see that if a ship reported an enemy contact, you didn't know where the hell the ship was reporting to. You didn't know who was reporting.
RT procedure was bad.
Oh, though. The actual, I'd say 4 out of 5 points were, I was able to show right away, after at 2 o'clock in the morning, that they had made mistakes. Bless their hearts.
Yeah, but
they 4 out of 5 things were not up to what we would hope for.
So what were your tactics, though? Did we have radar in these Corvettes?
Oh, some of them had a bit of radar.
The SWIC, SW1C.
Some had and some didn't.
Some didn't.
Some hadn't been fitted yet. Some were still out from refits.
Yeah. There's this business of turning when you suspect an attack, all escorts turn outwards and fire star shell.
Well, those points hadn't just been developed in those days.
It hadn't been developed.
No, we used to did it. I didn't.
Jeffrey Brock said that he invented it and told that to Percy Noble.
Yes, well...
in his book.
I did it when I was working with Mingy in 1940, early 40, when we did convoys. We used to try and put the submarines down so they wouldn't be in a position.
You did that, you turned outwards and fired star shell.
Oh, a great deal. Yes.
So that was not a new tactic.
Oh, no. No. But I want to explain, what happened. What happened in this training? I'll try and give you in a simple word.
Now, the MLs are trying to penetrate the screen.
Yes, they were trying to penetrate the screen, and they were acting as submarines.
Yeah.
Now, here we were. I sent for all captains. I was very depressed. We had an hour's conference, and I went ashore. I wasn't living in the ship. And I couldn't sleep. And that's the night I got up and I said, Jimmy Hibbert, things are wrong, but you're responsible to put it right. You're not here to criticize this. You've got to find an answer to this thing. These people can't be slaughtered to send them into battle in this condition. It is wrong. And not only that, they were not going to take the convoys. I got an old signal pad, and I drew on the back of that signal pad what turned out to be my escort teacher, my battle trainer. You see, there's not time to get these night exercises in. You couldn't get everybody into them. To get people trained under these conditions, you had to do it in a room somewhere. I can see you had to have a room where you could analyze what they'd done in battle, and I went, the next day I went to Halifax, I went to the then Commodore, I think it was, I'll tell you exactly who it was, Admiral Jones's brother-in-law,
Jones.
I mean, I have a couple of names when you get over 21, it came to me.
It'll come.
And
it's in the Navy list anyway.
Yeah. He was in charge of Commodore Halifax. And I went to him and I asked to have a shed. I found a shed that wasn't being used for much and cleared it out. And I developed in that shed what turned out to be my battle trainer. And we put a horizon around the shed.
Yeah.
We put black Hessen around. We built a bridge. Mm-hmm. We set little rooms aside to be, and everybody had its.
All the
control team was able to be put into this little room.
Yes, we have the pictures of it. I've sent them to Alec Douglas. The file numbers, And the Wrens would lower star shell if you fired star shell, and you had your depth charge.
All the procedure.
The pictures would all be there, and the explanations would all be there with Dr. Douglas.
Well, I have to say this.
So
we had a dedicated team.
Who were the team then?
I got Butch.
Yeah, what rank was he?
He was a gunner.
Thin stripe or thick stripe?
I think he was thin or thick. I can't remember.
All right.
Peck, who was
He was an ASDIC bosun.
Yes, ASDIC bosun.
ASDIC, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he was.
Yeah.
Then I had Briggs, who was...
That's P-E-C-K, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah. And then I had Briggs, who was... Ted Briggs, who was a wonderful talker, you know.
He was a CBC man.
Yes, and I had Ted Briggs, and then we got this team together, and Briggs could cover up if the black captain fell down, so by mistake, he'd say, that's cloud effect. Everything, he could answer for everything.
Now what contribution to the building of it? Who drew it? Pat Budge?
What happened was our first trainer was such a success, and it ran for a year, the little one.
Yeah.
Every ship was trying to get in on runs on it.
Do you remember the year that this
was
being?
Yes, I can remember the year very well, 1941.
And the month?
I would say about October.
So in October 41, you had a battle trainer working ashore.
Yes, a battle trainer ashore. Now, there was such a demand for this training, we drew up the plans for a second one. And I looked around for the people I could do, and I picked Mr. Justice Woods, later one of the justices of the Court of Appeal in Saskatchewan. You'll find him in Prentice's report on the battle trainer. You'll find his initials and name in that in detail.
Mm-hmm.
I picked him to be my commanding officer. He was a type of person who could get his teeth into this and understand the battle, and I got him, I made him captain of my battle trainer.
Well, what was his sea experience?
I can't remember.
But he had some.
I think I had him with me for a little time or somebody else. I can't remember in detail what his battle experience at that time. But he was the right type for this type.
Yeah.
I flew to Ottawa. And I leant over their shoulders and I said, we can't go on like this. I cannot have any delay. And there was a team in Ottawa at that time. I think it was Roland Mingy, whoever was there, got my point. And I saw the deputy minister and the minister, and they gave me a financial encumbrance number. What the hell that means, I have no idea, but a financial encumbrance number...
It means it's your money.
My money. And I could spend it, so I saw fit.
How much was it?
And didn't matter. No figure was put on it.
Ah.
And the thing was, they started to wake up in Ottawa at this time, that this thing was pretty serious, we were playing for keeps.
Was this Angus L. MacDonald?
Oh, he was there, yes. He was the one that... I saw him at the same time.
And he was...
Yep.
He's a marathon.
Yeah. And I think he was the real person behind this financial encumbrance number.
Yeah.
And also my brother, Godfrey Hibbert, who was in charge of shipbuilding.
Yeah.
I told him the only reason the ships got to Halifax is the river ran that way. He got the point.
Yeah.
And remember the problem at the time? There were defects in the ship.
Yeah.
People... getting them in there, training. I don't think you had to live this to believe it. And
there were design defects, too. Do you remember in the Corvettes, the first Corvette, the mast was right in front of the bridge.
Well,
and we didn't move it to abaft the bridge for a year or so. The forecastle, if it had been extended just another 20 feet, they could have at least got the food to the forward galleys without getting it wet with salt, with water coming down from the forecastle. So there were all these things, yes.
Well, now, here we were in a situation that was unbelievable. And I had the most dedicated team in the world. God bless them. They got behind this. They were aware how much I, you know, we had a mutual respect. I respected them, and I think they respected me. And my team got together and made a go of this thing.
Good. Now, how many ships did you put ship's company?
Well, that's all
put,
recorded. Isn't
put
it?
Through a day, one a day.
I can't remember.
No, but you'd have to spend most of the day there.
Oh, I didn't. No,
I don't mean you. I mean the ship's company.
I was training. I had the whole outfit to train, and I was captain. As a captain, acting, I had to be training commander for the Halifax, you see, and for the Atlantic. But I want to say this: that team got together and put as many ships as they could through a day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all recorded, how many ships in my papers.
Good.
It's how many went through. And Prentice has written up the whole story of the action trainer.
In Crow's Nest.
Yes.
I've got that.
You've got that. Well, I think I can't do more than leave Prentice. He was my boss, my Captain D.
Yeah.
And I leave that. I won't cover that. It doesn't need covering anymore, does it?
By the way, to go back a bit, Donald McIntyre says that Prentice was an RN officer loaned to the RCN. He might have been an RN officer, but he was living out...
He was a retired RN officer. He was a passed over, bless his heart.
Passed over two and a half.
Two and a half.
He came out here, and he joined the RCN.
I think that's correct.
Pugsley said... Yes. Donald McIntyre says he was loaned by the RN to the RCN. He wasn't. He joined the RCN.
And if you were ever doing anything for the historian, tell him to look up the book, the papers, the letter, signed by Admiral Mingy. He sat up all night writing this letter, one night, explaining the situation in Halifax, explaining what the requirements would be. And that letter is written to Admiral Murray, by Captain D. Halifax, signed by Prentice and sent on to Ottawa, that outlined the whole... That, if they could find that letter, I think it would be a tremendous help in seeing what the situation was at that day.
It was written in 41.
Written 42, I guess, before we got the letter. 41. Probably 41.
Late 41. Yep. You started the battle trainer early 41.
Yep, that's right. That's right.
All right.
That would be about the time. And... I hope they'll put their finger on that letter sometime.
Well, the researchers will go to work on it. If it exists, they'll find it.
And then I say,
now, what
Mr.
was
Justice Woods, I think he's Chief Justice now, I don't know, he did a wonderful job when I picked the right man to put him in command of this.
Yes.
And he was a good person for this.
Yeah.
And he, in conjunction with the staff, drew up the second battle trainer, which was built there, and they put modifications in that.
Yeah.
They all worked together. The whole team with me going to their meetings and once in a while.
Yeah.
This they drew up the second battle trainer.
And I've seen the blueprint on
have
it and the pictures. Now, you were doing other things. Now, things were still going on at Pictou and in St. Margaret's Bay. Yeah. What was going on there?
Well, just as training escort vessels.
How long did the ship get there before she went to sea? 2 days?
Sometimes 2 days, sometimes a week.
Yeah.
Sometimes two. It all depended on the demand. And the demand was terrific.
And who was... You couldn't be down in St. Margaret's Bay all the time running things.
No,
who
no.
was running things down there?
No, I had Budge and Peck doing most of the work down there.
In St. Margaret's Bay.
I had a Captain D's office to keep ticking. In Halifax. Yeah. I wasn't Captain D, but I was just training commander.
Yes.
But you can imagine.
So what were your other duties then?
Everything you can think of.
Well, I guess that's a dumb question. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I know that's a dumb question. I won't put that on this. I think I'll leave it on just to show how dumb I can be. So you were training commander then for how long?
For a year and a half.
And that takes us up to the middle of 42.
January, about a year and a half. Yeah. And that was the... Well, can I just finish on the battle trainer?
Please.
We added a tactical table to that battle trainer. We added I started a command course, which I put... In command of the command course, I put Martin Ellis.
Yes.
I remember the day
schoolie.
His schoolie, yes. And a damn good... person. I remember the day we opened the command course. I can still show you a picture of the first officers in the command course.
So you instigated the command course.
And the tactical table and all the conferences that went on in conjunction. You see, you ran a battle in the battle trainer.
Yeah.
And then you spent 2 hours analyzing the battle.
Yeah. Now, the command course. What did you do there? You said that likely first lieutenants were to come back ashore and take a command course.
Take command course. All people who looked like commanding corvettes, and they, I'll show you the picture sometime. We sent you. I've got still got that picture of the first command course.
Yeah.
And I got Murray to come down and open it, and Prentice was there, and we had a whole lot of names you'll remember.
And I suppose they spent a lot of their time on the battle trainer.
Yes, battle trainers. And
They get on their syllabus things like captain's business, you know, the master's business in the merchant service, the captain's business. They learned about...
It was mostly the tactics of the battle. We concentrated in that battle trainer on... WACIs, you know, Western Approaches Convoy Instructions. How to fight a battle.
Yeah, because this is the beginning. You see what I'm leading to. This is the beginning. You've had your time at sea. You've got your feet wet. You've been in action. You've started a battle trainer. And now you've started a command course.
Yeah, and a tactical table.
And a tactical table.
Very much the same as they had in Liverpool.
And to move on in time, which we'll come to presently... I was one of the first junior officers technical and leadership course, and you came down from Ottawa and told us how badly we needed. And we sniffed a bit because, damn it, we had just won the Battle of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And after we had finished, this is a compliment that I've owed you for a good 30 years. After we had finished, there were 22 of us in that course, and after we had finished it, we wondered how the hell we ever got along without all that knowledge that we had just learned in the previous year. And Commander Ralph Hennessy was running us. So you see your position as trainer. Tactical trainer, attack teacher, command course, the JOTLC, and then we'll move on to other things. So the command course started.
Yeah. Where are we now? We're just about into 1943, starting with those were all underway in 42.
Yes.
All underway in that 42. And I was up at Pictou, inspecting about 10 ships up there and doing night exercises with them, when a car came up to get me from Halifax. And somebody said, for Commander Hibbert, and what they want, you've got to get back to Halifax, you've got to fly to England in under 48 hours, you've been booked to fly over on a bomber because the Iroquois needs a new captain had gone sick.